Hey friends, I want to thank our sponsors, and I want you to know that putting together a show like Hansel Minutes takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of editing, a website to manage, a lot of bandwidth, and without our sponsors, we couldn't make it happen. So first, I want to thank Raygun. Raygun provides full-stack error, crash, and performance monitoring for tech teams. Whether you're a software engineer who's looking to diagnose and resolve issues with greater speed and accuracy, or a product manager who's drowning in bug reports, or you're just concerned that you're losing customers to poor quality online experiences, Raygun can provide you with the answers. You get full-stack error and performance monitoring in one place. So the next time you're struggling to replicate errors and performance issues in your code base, think Raygun. Head over to raygun.com, that's R-A-Y-G-U-N.com. You can get up and running in minutes, and you can dramatically improve the online experiences of your users. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I have the distinct pleasure of chatting with Star Trek visual effects master Dan Curry. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you. How about yourself?
I'm very well and thrilled to be chatting with you, although I must say, looking at your accolades and online, I could probably spend about 5 or 10 minutes doing just an intro of you and all the stuff that you've done over the years. It's quite a career you've had.
Well, it's kept me from stealing a shopping cart and moving under a bridge.
you were involved in Star Trek for what now? You're 18 years? And
18 years.
And that's a very small number of people who were in the 18-year club working on four different shows.
Yeah, I think it was maybe around 10, give or take one or two on either side, but it wasn't a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. The things that you were in charge of varied. You did everything from visual effects to title creation. You even worked on Star Trek IV, the movie.
That's correct.
And you also did second unit director work. Why do you have such a diverse background? Did they just say, oh, let Dan do it. He'll do a great job. Or is this typical?
Well, it's not. Visual effects people frequently do second unit directing because the shots are so technical sometimes, where, say, the regular episodic director doesn't have the time to spend 4 hours on a given shot. They're racing to get their day done. And they may not necessarily have the expertise or even the patience sometimes to do these shots that may require various elements, and especially shooting people in front of green screen or their explosions. So it takes a long time. So that's why frequently the second unit director is the visual effects supervisor. And other times, sometimes if it's a stunt thing, the second unit director is the stunt coordinator.
Oh, okay. So given that you're the one who's helping coordinate the building of the props and the creation of the effects, you're uniquely set to be the second unit director if those are the shots that have all of those effects.
Well, yeah. And the thing is, my background is in filmmaking. I have an MFA at both film and theater. Mm. And years ago, when I got out of the Peace Corps in Thailand, I worked for the Thai Department of Education and directed a weekly Thai language educational series.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a fantastic way is that what the beginning of your career, to start your career that way?
Well, it was a great experience in Thailand, but I've been making movies since I was very young. After seeing The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and reading about how they did that, Ray Harryhausen, the genius, did a lot of things with rear projection. So I had a broken 8mm movie projector. So I taped some tracing paper inside a cardboard box and put my broken projector on one side and shot movies of my brother screaming, and then put a toy dinosaurs lumbering around in the foreground. So that was beginning of my visual effects career.
And Ray Harryhausen, in fact, the kind of the creator of a stop motion form of animation known as Dynamation, one of the early stop motion experts and innovators.
Yeah, and the influence of Ray on the film industry can't be underestimated. He was a very important figure, but then again, Ray owes Willis O'Brien homage too, because Willis doing the first King Kong and the silent version of Lost Continent, Willis was the real pioneer.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Working with Willis on things like Mighty Joe Young and the, you know, some of the early color films in the late 40s.
That's true.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is interesting about the fact that you, of course, brought up, Harryhausen is there wasn't a lot of visual effects because there wasn't any CGI. And one of the things that I think people appreciate about Star Trek over the years is the balance between practical effects and high quality sets and props and, not being heavy handed with the graphics.
Well, there were always visual effects. They were just not done on the computer. They were done mm-hmm. either in camera or using optical printing for compositing. And one of the great things about the Star Trek franchise is that it mirrored the evolution of visual effects technology. When we started Next Generation, everything was done photographically with the exception of compositing. And it was one of the courageous decisions by Paramount to issue optical printer compositing to result in a film negative as a final product and do it with video compositing. And early on, we were doing 1-inch analog compositing. And then as D1 came along, or D5 rather, then we moved up to true digital compositing. But early on, we were still doing matte paintings in oils and physical models on motion control rigs to make to do the space scenes. And then right after the end of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, we were getting into CG because the demands of the shows were so great, we didn't have time to shoot physical models and get done in time. So we did some hybrid shows early on where the foreground ships were physical models, but the background ships were CG. And early on, the CG models didn't look quite as real. There were artifacts of stretching skins around 3D wireframes and stuff. But by the time we got to Star Trek Enterprise, CG had hit a level of verisimilitude that made sense. And Enterprise was the first all CG Star Trek show.
Oh, wow. Do people in the business, in yourself and your compatriots, did you get a little sad or wistful or when you move from physical models to CG? Or do you say, oh, this just lets us do our job that much more effectively?
There's always a little of both. Every technological innovation is a two-edged sword. Mm-hmm. And doing things early on, it was a lot of, say, visual equivalent of medieval alchemy. How can we make something look like something it's not? There was one episode in Next Generation, Arsenal of Freedom, where we had a drone satellite was supposed to re-enter the atmosphere and burn up. And of course, we couldn't do that. So I had the idea of gluing slivers of plastic bag onto a model covered with black flocking and photographing it with electric fans causing the streamers to blow around. And by keeping the shutter open for 3 seconds a frame, it created this motion blur that looked like hot gases coming off the model. And then by using that as a window or a keying element, we printed real fire through that. And it looked like the reentry heat of something entering an atmosphere.
Oh, wow. Did you know this or do you intuit that this might work?
We intuited. A sprint doing Star Trek because we were expected to do half a feature every few weeks. So we would have a guess on how to do something and based on experience and despair can be the mother of invention. But mostly it was just intuitive guessing that, oh, this would probably work. And sometimes we would grit our teeth and live with something we were not really happy with. And other times we were delighted with how well it came out.
Mm. It's interesting that you brought up that particular episode, given how many episodes you worked on, because one of the devices, one of the drones, the Echo Popa drones from the Arsenal of Freedom is actually up for auction. And a lot of your collections, some of the props and things that you've collected over the last 18 years are up at Heritage Auctions. And we'll have a link for that in the show notes where people can go to entertainment.ha.com and we'll put you directly to the sets later this week. And that means literally this week of the second week of April. I believe the auction starts on the 15th of April. You can see these props. And in fact, this one, this Echo Popa, or I'm not sure how that pronounced, Echo Popa drone is up there. This is something you collected and just, did you just walk away off the set with these things?
No. I actually made it and no one walked away off the set. That would not be too ethical. It was just wound up with it. And that when we were done, it was either throw it in the dumpster or keep it. And it, because I made it myself, I thought it would be just something cool to have around. And over the years, just wound up with too much stuff. So we're trying to minimalize our material possessions and thought it would be good to share some of these objects with fans that are interested.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And in fact, there were a number of drones that were created and one of them, of course, went into the atmosphere and had that effect that you just described.
That's correct. That's one of them. And then the one we saw on the planet's surface is there. And interestingly enough, in that episode, we had a jungle set built on stage at Paramount. And there was an earlier design that looked like a three-pronged claw flying around. It was very heavy. Mm-hmm. The initial idea was to shoot it practically, and it was too heavy to run on wires. It was too heavy to carry. And the claws kept snagging in the branches of the jungle. So the producers came to me and said, let's figure something out at the last minute. So I took a plastic Easter egg and glued a shampoo bottle on it with some little ribbed tube to hide that normally is used to hide cables, and then glued a legs pantyhose container on the bottom and used blue Dymo label tape for ports on the little drone robot, and then shot it in front of a green screen. And so the blue allowed me to pull a key from just the ports on the device, and then the green gave us an overall mat. And the other thing that was different about that, everybody thought I was crazy. I decided not to shoot the model drone with motion control.
Oh, wow.
Which would have taken a long time. And I just felt that sometimes motion control is too perfect and too time consuming. And since the thing was supposed to flutter around and react to the branches in the jungle, what I decided to do is I put it upside down on the end of a pole, put on an embarrassing green suit, and stood in front of a green screen. And by that time, I'd done Tai Chi for about 20 years. So I learned how to move slowly and with as much grace as my clumsiness can muster. And so all the motions of that drone robot were actually done by hand by me carrying it on a pole.
That is unbelievable. You can, I actually have a link in the show notes to the that segment of the of that episode, episode 21 of season one. And you won't believe it. You won't believe a number of things. You're describing assembling this drone out of plastics and what you had available to you. But when you see it on screen, it's almost impossible to believe. It looks amazing. And if you look at the pictures that we'll link to up on the Heritage Auction site, you'll agree that it's almost impossible as a layman to hear you describe, oh yeah, and I took a Hanes pantyhose egg, and that, you know, just seemed like a good idea at the time. And it still looks like $1 million on the screen.
Well, I also painted it. And when you do something like that, you do a base coat of gray. And then I just airbrushed it so it would look metallic, and did very subtle color differences where there were a little bit of blue, a little bit of magenta. And those color variations make it look very, very reflective and metallic. And that was the key with that one, is to the paint job on it. And also I was looking for something elegant, and there's something wonderful in found objects that I guess for me, it's instinctive. I can look at things independent of their original purpose and their scale. So say if I go to a hardware store and look in the plumbing section, there might be a little sleeve to use as a to repair underground sprinklers. And I wound up using that as the core body for a space lifeboat.
Wow. Hey, this is Scott. Just jumping in for a quick message from our sponsors. They make this show possible. Are you looking to build real-time contact data validation and enrichment into your applications? Check out Melissa's developer portal. You'll gain easy access to flexible APIs for global address verification, phone, IP address, email, and property and business data. Sample code and get post methods, technical documentation, it's all included, and quick online payment makes rapid application development easy. Visit melissa.com/developer. That's melissa.com/developer, or just call 1-800-MELISSA. Is painting such like the most important skill? Because it's such a multimodal and diverse set of skills one needs, like the ability to airbrush something and to know how light hits any surface, even a plastic surface, and make plastic look like metal. Is it all come down to painting?
No, it's lighting. Painting is one factor. Lighting is the other. How it moves is another issue. And that's one of the things that makes film and television such a wonderful art form, because it's the combination of all art forms. It's and dance in a way, like in the way I move the that drone robot, it basically is dance. Or and the way a great camera operator moves is also a form of dance. And so you have painting, sculpture, and with models, it's sculpture. And the great model makers like Greg Jean and Tony Meininger and some of the others we worked with, those guys are true artists and they're great sculptors, but they're also technically on top of what they're doing. So they know how to hold light back, how to do wiring, how to make parts move. So the other heroic geniuses of Star Trek were the model makers who built the hero models like the Enterprise, Deep Space Nine, Voyager. Those guys were amazing and deserve the abiding respect of fans.
I'm looking at one of the lots that's up called the Worker Bee shuttlecraft that was used in Star Trek The Next Generation. And fortunately, the images online here are extremely high resolution, so I can basically get my face right up to it, much closer than one would ordinarily get to such a thing. And when you get close to it, you can see where things were glued and where hot glue was used and where, what's an LED and what's not. So one, and by no means do I mean to diminish the work, but when one gets abnormally close to one of these things, the illusion is gone and you can see that like one of the nacelles is actually a Gillette razor handle. But if you simply move a foot away, that illusion disappears, and now suddenly you're really looking at a spaceship, and it looked amazing on screen.
Well, yeah, that another one that it's some of the old guard visual effects guys would call it the joke or the gag, because it's a form of prestidigitation, and so in that case, I knew we would never get that close to it, and we used it only when Enterprise was in dry dock, and I borrowed a broken robot foot from my son's toy bin and glued those razors on it and a couple of other parts. And my colleague, Gary Hutzel, wired it up with the LED lights, and and that was it. And but by knowing that we wouldn't get too close to it and making sure that there were enough interesting surface details to catch light and make moving shadows, that's what gives it that feeling of verisimilitude in context, because people see it go by, but they're really looking at the Enterprise and looking at the grand scope of the whole dry dock situation.
Yeah, exactly. That holistic, it's not just a model close up in the stark bright white lights of the internet. It's everything in whole with light and sound and motion.
Yeah, it's context.
It is context, absolutely. Some of the things that are up here on the auction are amazing. The Voyager Borg City, some concept sculptures. Are the concept sculptures not used in the show, but rather used to model CGI effects?
Exactly. Sometimes, whether it's people in the art department or myself, would do drawings for what we had in mind, and of course the producers would have to approve them. But in case of certain things that are very, very complicated, a drawing would be very difficult and to interpret. So I went into my, I have a modest wood shop at home. So I went in and started with a cube and then built out for it, thinking about how the Borgs think, that they are eminently pragmatic and they don't make artistic design decisions. The shape of objects is form followed function. And so as the Borg city expanded, they'd keep adding on and adding on, like an endless housing development, and they just build something that they needed. So I approached creating that conceptual model that way. Here's a cube. Well, now they need a little thing that does this kind of work. Now they have a science lab over here. And so I just built it intuitively and then painted it up. And that made it a lot easier for the CG artists to build that city, because they could walk around and look at it from different sides. And so I explained, well, let's assume that this cube is a kilometer and a half on each side. And then it just goes on for hundreds of miles. And they got it immediately and did, of course, their usual brilliant job.
Fantastic. It's the sculptural equivalent of a rough sketch. And you say, look at, make it like this.
That's exactly right. It's a sculptural equivalent of a rough sketch. And hot glue is something that's a great tool for that, because you can glue stuff together very instantly and work fast. And then I went back and reinforced everything with epoxy at all the joints.
Oh, wow. And now it's, of course, as it's being auctioned off, it is mounted on a nice plate and felt covered wood base, and would look great, certainly on my mantle or someone's mantle.
Well, I would hope so. And my goal is that these things, you know, shouldn't be buried in my garage or my storage unit. They should be in the hands of people that the work of any artist. They want people to own them and appreciate them for what they are.
Yeah, indeed. One of the other things that I was interested in is not just creating, certainly not just creating effects, but conceiving of things that are now somewhat iconic. You created the Batleth Klingon sword and the KLS's sword from Deep Space Nine is actually part of this auction as well. How does that come about? Does a writer conceive of, like, the Klingon's got a mean looking knife, and then you take it from there, or how does that work?
How that came about was, we had an episode of TNG where Worf was to inherit a primordial Klingon bladed weapon. And the first idea that came down was something that looked like a pirate's cutlass. And I looked at it, and it had a couple of flanges on it. And even as a boy, I didn't like movie weapons that were designed to look cool but weren't. Mm-hmm. And not to disparage the original design, but I had been imagining what became the Batleth for a long time, but never had any reason to bring it into existence. So I made one out of foam core and went into the producer's office and said, hey, let's do something that's never existed before. So the Klingons have something unique to their culture, but it also is ergonomically sound as a weapon. So, and then I said, I can make up a whole series of moves for this. And the producers looked at it and said, cool, let's do it. So then I got the chance to work with our wonderful stunt coordinator, Dennis Madelone, who at first had a grim opinion of it, until I said, well, look, Dennis, we can do this and this and this. And suddenly he became very excited about it. And Dennis and one of the other stunt guys, Tommy Morga, became real masters of using the Batleth. So when it came time to Going back to the Batliff, it's the Korean Martial Arts Association approved it as one of the first new bladed weapon in 200 years that has practical value. And even the Navy Department of Research contacted me and wanted to talk to me about my ideas about weapon ergonomics. And when it came time on Deep Space Nine for the Sword of Kalos, Kalos being the quintessential Klingon warrior, and I always just imagined Kalos as being something like the great Irish warrior Cú Chulainn from Celtic history. And so I thought, well, Kalos should have something like the Batleth, but it should be more vicious and more Baroque because of the intensity of violence in his time period. So I had this idea of doing this central spike in the middle for, I call it a disembowelment flange, and other flanges on the weapon so you could grapple an opponent's weapon and inflict harm on your opponent in an even greater variety of ways.
My goodness. And this has become such a thing, though, over the last, you know, many years, that you can find sword makers and blacksmiths who will take creating a batleth to make it and to create it and then to do a video about it as a challenge.
What's also was interesting is how many people claim they invented it.
Which is interesting, given that you created the original prop that was used, and then only two were made, one for an exhibit and one for your own collection, which is now being auctioned off.
Yeah, that was the one that was my compensation for helping provide stuff to the Las Vegas Star Trek experience. So when Gil Hibben, who is one of America's national treasures, he's a great knife maker, knife throwing Hall of Fame, and also master of the rhythm bones, a Neolithic instrument, kind of like castanets. And so Gil made the one for Las Vegas, and he made a second one for me as a favor.
Yeah, indeed. And he also created the knife in Rambo. So Gil Hibben is a master knife maker.
And the Expendables. And if you look up Gil Hibben online, he does these incredible fantasy knives that are beautiful works of art.
Yeah, I'm going to include links to all of this in the show notes. So given the length of your career and the depth and breadth of the things that you worked on, I'm curious, now that we've got social media and everyone online and the rise of cosplay, what do you feel about watching different amateur cosplayers create their props out of foam core and techniques that you and your compatriots started with?
I think it's cool. It's very flattering to see so many people be inspired and want to do that. And I sometimes get videos of from people showing how they come up with their own kata or form to use the batleth. And then I'll give them advice. And I tend to advise them not to use them as choppers, but there should be much more a fluid kind of a Tai Chi-like motion, so that when you're using a heavy weapon, you really wind up getting its momentum going and guiding it rather than using it as a Vegematic chopper.
Yeah, indeed. It's meant to be a weapon, but an elegant weapon, not a sloppy weapon.
I would hope so.
Yeah. And it sounds like your expertise in Tai Chi and martial arts informed a lot of the work that you did.
Yeah. And I think weapons is something I've always been interested in as a boy, watching medieval movies and movies set in ancient times. So weapons always fascinated me. And Star Trek gave me a wonderful home where a lot of my goofy skills actually had value.
Mm. I'm curious, do you think that this is going to become a lost art, the creation of more practical effects, physical props and miniatures? Or do you think that we are still in the golden age of creating these kinds of effects?
Well, there will always be physical props because actors need to interact with them and hold them and use them. Mm-hmm. And it's going to ebb and flow. The wonderful aspect of CG, and certainly it's evolved to an incredible art form, is that anything we can imagine is now doable in a very convincing way. And so as resolution gets greater and greater and computing power gets greater and greater, CG is still in its infancy, and I just think as future generations evolve the art form, it's just going to get better and better. And you look at some of the the great tentpole films that are coming out, and you know that with the hundreds of million dollar budgets, the work done in terms of water simulation and rain and so forth, it's truly remarkable what can be accomplished.
Yeah, indeed. It does feel, though, sometimes that the at least the American movie audience somehow gets jaded, and they say, "Oh, you know, Transformers was just a mess of CG and robots bashing." As they couldn't tell what was going on screen. There's too much, so there's definitely too much CG that can happen at some point.
I would kind of argue with that a little bit. It's basically the vision of the filmmaker. That's like the King of Sweden telling Mozart there are too many notes in your piece of music. I think what happens, it's not so much an issue of too much CG, mm-hmm. but CG existing for its own sake and dominating the story. And ultimately, people want to be told stories that have some revelation about the human condition.
That is a valid point. And indeed, ultimately, using Transformers as the whipping boy in this example, this is the vision of the director, and certainly the visual effects team gave him exactly what he asked for.
That's true, because the visual effects team, the vision of the director or in television, more importantly, it's the producers that are the creative through line, because they're different directors for most episodes, so that the creative consistency comes from the producers who supervise and maintain a stylistic consistency and a thematic consistency in a given show.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Oh, thank you. It was very enjoyable.
I wish you all the best of luck on your April 15th, 2008 auction at Heritage Auctions. And I would encourage folks that are listening to the show to take a look at the show notes. We'll include links to all the different lots and also information and links that Dan and I chatted with. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.